Tickets are on sale now for Spotlight On's next live event, an all-ages show at the Royal Room in Seattle, Washington, on June 22, 2024. Spotlight On: Improvisation in Music and Life will be a unique program of performance and conversation between me and the James Falzone Division Ensemble. Together, we'll explore the nature of improvisation in music and how its principles can be useful in all aspects of life, for musicians and non-musicians alike. Different types of composing in the moment will be demonstrated, interspersed with interludes of discussion, covering what each musician brings to and gets from the experience. Audience members will become participants through a Q&A session that will afford a rare opportunity to gain deeper insight into the art and science of improvisation. Falzone's Division Ensemble is a group of master improvisers that includes James Falzone on clarinet, Ray Larson on trumpet, Wayne Horvitz on piano, Abby Blackwood on bass, and Rocky Martin on drums. For tickets and other information, visit spotlightonpodcast.com or theroyalroomseattle.com. For those of you who cannot join us in person, we would still welcome and appreciate your support in the form of a ticket purchase. If you can, please do, as it would mean the world to us and to this important independent venue. Thanks. Hello and welcome to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Today the spotlight shines on Will Barnes, leader of the Will Barnes Quartet, who joins me to talk about his life in music and specifically his ongoing collaboration with landscape artist Aaron Hughes. Their first album together, Source of the Severn, is a 21st century take on classic bebop era sounds. Aaron contributed 9 original works of art in response to Will and the quartet's music, using her own hand-marbled papers as a palette with which to create collages that evoke the mid-Wales landscape in which the participants all dwell. The Will Barnes Quartet featuring Aaron Hughes will be touring throughout the year. Aaron will be providing a special live visual show as part of each performance, leading to a very unique interaction between her, the band, and the audiences. Be sure to check it out if you can. Thanks for making time.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You know, given how sort of unique your collaboration or your band's collaboration is with Aaron, I had 2 questions to start off. One is, if you could talk a little bit about the roots of your collaboration together, how you got to know each other and each other's work, but also, were there any sort of precedents that you had in mind as you started to work together as to what you might aspire for your collaboration to be?
So the first part, it was kind of more simple than you might imagine. Aaron's actually my neighbor, but I only have 3 neighbors where I live in the darkest depths of mid Wales. And by pure chance, she happens to be one of them. We just got to know each other a little bit, and I was planning on making this record with my quartet. And I really wanted to get her involved just as a very small part to maybe do the cover artwork or something like that. So I popped around to see her, and a couple of bottles of wine later, and we started to concoct this idea of a full collaboration and things like that. So it built up a bit of momentum on its own. And in terms of, did we have any benchmark for it or inspiration for it? Initially, no. But then when we started talking about creating a live element of this, as well as just the kind of art and the recording, we started sort of referencing old psychedelic bands like Pink Floyd and the Grateful Dead and things like that. And we thought how cool it would be to have that visual thing happening live. But for the initial kind of thing, it was more just us getting a little bit excited over a glass of Rioja or two.
Am I correct in my understanding that the live show is more performative on her part as well? Like she's, as you mentioned, like with some of the psychedelic light shows and stuff, she's creating in real time.
That's right. Yeah. So she's using the same kind of like liquid light techniques that those guys were using in the late 60s and 70s in reaction to the music as it's happening live. Yeah.
Did she have any experience with any media like that before?
a small amount, I think, but it was certainly a learning curve for everybody. Yeah, she went on a bit of a quest to gain more knowledge from it. Yeah, so it was, yeah, good experience for us all.
What did you and the other musicians have to learn or adapt to? How did it impact your part of the show?
For starters, we had to remember that we had a fifth person there who was also improvising with us, although she is located generally behind the audience at the, towards the back of the performance space, purely so she gets a full visual look at what's going on at all times. So that's quite an interesting thing, because there's this slight kind of feeling of separation between her and us. So trying to bring her in somehow to what we're doing, and also just being aware that there's this big visual thing happening behind us that we can't see. So we have to kind of remember to take a glance every now and again and see what sort of mood she's creating so we can react to that a little as well.
So you did have some intention around it being more than just set dressing. There was an interaction between the stage artists and the visual art.
Yeah, absolutely. And we always bill it as the Will Barnes Quartet featuring Erin Hughes, as you would if we had a guest horn player or a guest singer or something. She definitely is a fifth member of the band.
That's fascinating. When did she get involved in the album process? And I don't mean necessarily from the relationship point of view. I meant more specifically, was the music all written? Was it all recorded? How collaborative was that? Or was she more reactive at that point?
That was more of a reactive process, purely just from the way that the timeline ran in the creation of this project. So the original conception was I wanted to write a suite of compositions that reflected the landscape in Mid Wales, where we live, right, very close to the border between England and Wales. And it has its own sort of magic. It is sort of very different kind of person that lives on the borders versus in the depths of either of those countries. And the landscape's very different as well. So that was the original conception. It was just going to be music. So I just forged ahead and did that. And then obviously after speaking to Erin, and we came up with the idea of her creating a bespoke piece of art for each track that helped to sort of tie in visually the concept that I had for the music. It was always a vinyl that we had in mind. So you had something big that you could open and that you could look at when you were listening to the record and hopefully try and ignite people's imaginations and transport them into the landscape as they're listening to the tracks. So she, in this instance, yes, she reacted to the already written compositions. Although she didn't hear the final takes from the studio, I just made some rough demos and just to give her a flavor of what was going to happen.
You alluded to the difference in the people who live in that border area versus the heartland of either territory. What does that mean to you in practical terms?
You grow up having a bit of a mixed identity, I suppose, because a lot of my friends, they may be born of both English or both Welsh parents, but have lived themselves the other side of the border, or maybe have one parent English, one parent Welsh. And then there can be a real strong sense of identity, and people can be quite kind of patriotic, especially when it comes to sporting events like the rugby. However, there's this like kind of mixed feeling that you get as well, where it's like, well, just to travel to work, I have to cross the border four times in and out of each country. So we have all the identities and none of them all at once.
Has that element of life gotten more complicated as a result of Brexit, or is that considered within the United Kingdom? I'm sorry, I'm a bit of the ignorant American on this topic.
No, that's fine. we've got the devolved nations over here in the UK, and there's a sort of there's a strong camp that would like to see more of a kind of independent Wales, and then there's a strong camp that would like to keep the United Kingdom Union going. It hasn't caused any practical problems post-Brexit for Wales in particular, but yeah, there certainly is some interesting things when we're living and working on the border. Rules are ever so slightly different. I'm not sure whether you find the same when you cross state lines. You have these slightly different kind of rules in force that you have to adapt to quite quickly.
Yeah, I think as Americans, it's a bit, I guess, more subtle would be the right way to say it, although increasingly less subtle because of the sort of bifurcation or we're having more and more tensions at the state level between states, social policies, things of that nature. In the old days, it used to just be things like the speed limit might be different. You know,
yeah,
now it's some states you drive into and like you could carry a gun on your person like that. You wouldn't get that in some other state. So it's very jarring that way and very noticeable. It does often feel like you're going into a different country, even though it's people who speak the same language and everything else is the same. The differences are getting highlighted, I guess would be the way to say it.
Yeah.
I noticed a lot in other conversations with you and other references you made that it seems that, I hope I'm concluding this correctly, it seems like Oscar Peterson, sort of an important figure to you or an important musician to you. I'm curious specifically about Peterson, given that you play a different instrument, and more broadly, what other music did you cut your teeth on growing up?
Yeah, Oscar Peterson's kind of been there from the get-go for me. My auntie's a music teacher. When I was quite a young age, she gifted me records for birthdays and Christmas and stuff. And Oscar Peterson would be a frequent kind of guest in those gift givings. She was a big fan herself. The sort of bluesy side of jazz always resonates with me. So players that have really got that kind of old tradition of jazz coming from the blues, and that's still very much in their play. I mean, I love modern stuff. I love conceptual stuff as well, but I'm always a sucker for your kind of Wes Montgomery's and your Oscar Peterson's and your Herb Ellis's and Hank Moby, the guys and girls that can really hone in on the core blues element of jazz. And I think with Oscar Peterson, that's it. And then the other thing is just his trio swings, man. They just swing. And that excited me as a young man, you know, and still does.
Mobley's a great one to name drop as well. I came late to his work through my interest in McCoy Tyner, and then I saw that he was on a bunch of the Blue Note records in the 60s. Yeah. Just like this muscular, solid playing, just really,
yeah,
like tough almost, you know what I mean? Beautiful, but strong.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And I think that's the kind of blues coming out in him. It's like you hear B.B. King, he's got the same thing going on, like it's really from the soul.
Is your guitar pantheon filled with sort of blues players? I think I read that an important record for you was Jim Hall and Pat Metheny.
Yeah.
Where do guitar players fit in your world?
Pat Metheny was another really early one, and Jim Hall, particularly Pat Metheny. And then when I was a teenager, I just became an absolute Django nut. I couldn't believe that I was hearing the recordings of the guitarist from so long ago, recordings from like the late 30s, with a guitar player that could play with that speed and that ferocity and that dexterity. And then when I found out he only had two fingers, it was game over for me. I was like, I've just got to study this guy. So I took a big chunk of my study time into the music of Django, alongside listening to lots of other things as well. And then, loads of different styles of music as well. I mean, I'm a big heavy metal fan as well, huge. My record collection consists, I suppose the biggest three genres in my record collection would be jazz, heavy metal, and reggae. It's just the ones I got the most records on, so they must be my favorites.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think I realized that coming into the call, but I think if we were to sit down, if you were to come into my record room where I came into yours, we might have some significant overlap. Those are three
great,
very important genres for me as well. All right, well, maybe play a game with me then. Let's pretend your records are segregated by genre. You walk into the heavy metal section. What are you drawn to? Like, what do you grab? What's your go-to?
Ooh. The first stuff I really listened to, thanks to my mum, was Black Sabbath, the early albums with Ozzy. A lot of that kind of Midlands British heavy metal scene, Judas Priest, things like that. When I was about 10 years old, I became an absolute Metallica nut. I just couldn't get enough of them. My parents were, God bless, brilliant. They took me to see Metallica when I was like 12 years old. I keep trying to say, well, you should take me again, but they don't want to know these days. But
they did their time.
So yeah, and then, yeah, they did their time. And then it goes right through. I mean, I'm listening to a lot of kind of modern stuff as well. I like stuff from Scandinavia, some of the kind of darker stuff from over there. American stuff as well. A few months, 6 months ago, I went to see Cannibal Corpse. Obviously, quite an interesting deviation from jazz, but yeah, I like all kinds of metal, you know.
Scandinavia's always had that weird sort of, going way back, certainly to the 80s when I was growing up. Think about King Diamond and Merciful Fate and all that. Like, it must be the Dark Nights or something, that the months of darkness that generate that stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a phenomenal record. It's just been released by Ishan, the singer from Emperor, and he's written a whole orchestral score to go with it. You can buy the two versions of the album, the sort of rocking heavy version, and then you can buy just the orchestral version. And it's very cinematic. It's an incredible album. Yeah.
It's really interesting to talk about some of those artists in the context of like the blues influence in metal and where that actually dropped off. Do you hear the blues at all as a lineage in a band like Metallica?
Maybe in Metallica still a little bit, because Kirk Hammett, he's like all about Jimi Hendrix and all of the kind of like British blues invasion guitarist Eric Clapton and all that bluesbreaker stuff. He loves all that, Jeff Beck. So I think you can, when it comes to the solos, because he just lets rip on his pentatonic blues stuff and it's great. But maybe some of the other stuff I listen to, more of the kind of death and black metal stuff, probably less in there. It comes in some of the kind of Black Sabbath-y sort of stuff. There's a spin-off genre of that, the stoner kind of rock. They're very bluesy. But yeah, perhaps not so much the Scandinavian stuff.
And is it because that stuff came from more of a Western European classical or modern composition tradition? Like, what do you think the drop off is about there?
I don't know. I always find it hard to write in a bluesy style when you're also trying to sound very dark as well. You end up going more towards the classical things. If I'm trying to write a piece of music that's much more sort of dark in its feel, it's not going to be as bluesy. Whereas if I'm trying to write something that's a bit kind of cooler and a bit more swinging and happening, I'm going to gravitate more towards the blues there.
We'll be back with more Spotlight On right after this break. Did you know that Spotlight On is completely self-funded by the team that produces it? We're looking for ways to keep the podcast self-sufficient without sacrificing the listener experience or the integrity of the show. The best way we could think of was to ask for the support of our listeners. Please consider making a donation to help cover our annual operating expenses. Go to spotlightonpodcast.com and click the word donate. If you can, please do. And if you cannot, please continue to enjoy the show. We're happy to have you as a listener. Thanks. And now, back to Spotlight On. All right. What about the reggae section? What's in the reggae section that...
Obviously, lots of classics, Wailers Tosh, all that kind of stuff. The Dub Guys, King Tubby, Burning Spear, all that kind of thing. But I'm quite interested in the kind of the current contemporary scene as well. So some of my favorite artists at the moment would be like Protégé, Chronix, Coffee, She's Grey, Kabaka Pyramid. And then there's a really cool scene like bubbling away in the UK at the moment as well. We've got Mungo's Hi-Fi and Gentleman's Dub Club, and then Prince Fatty, who's producing all sorts of artists and making some fantastic records at the moment. Yeah, I'm quite interested in trying to find a lot of the new stuff at the moment. And then the sort of stuff from the Southern Hemisphere as well, Fat Freddy's Drop and all those guys, Black Seeds.
Yeah, I have not stayed current on reggae in several years, but coming out of the lockdowns here, I think it was, I don't remember, I must have been summer of 22, Burning Spear toured here, and he hadn't toured in a long time. My teenage son and I went, and it was just, it was like perfect to be in a room full of people like that and seeing Spear. And for the last four or five songs of the set, he took his shirt off and he was like the mighty Spear. It was so great. It was so
excellent.
Great. Yeah, it was the real deal. How and if do these other elements and interests of yours sneak their way into your compositions and into your music?
I can definitely see how the metal would, because it's quite closely related to classical music in my mind. With heavy metal, it's all about composition, execution of composition, whereas obviously with jazz, it's much more about improvising and very much in the moment. So the sections of my music that I want to arrange heavily to create a certain vibe, whatever the night, I think that's where I pull more from my kind of heavy metal roots. And then the improvising section, obviously that's when I guess I'll be pulling more from my kind of blues side.
What was your musical education? Did you have formal training?
My education as a whole was, it was in and out of my life. I wasn't the greatest student when I was in school. I wanted to get out of there as soon as I could, and I managed to land myself a job in a local recording studio, much to my parents' dismay. We bargained for a couple of years of me going and doing a sort of slight A-levels, like slightly further education thing that you can do. I guess it'd be similar to sort of college. My heart wasn't really in it. I wanted to be at the studio, so I'd be at the studio till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, sitting on sessions, helping, making teas, rolling up cables or whatever, and then sort of drive myself home and then try and get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and go to college and sleep through whatever lectures I had until I could get back to the studio again. And I went on a quest really of self-knowledge, and once I was finally allowed out of state education by my parents, I got a job, and then I used money from that job to find private tutors. So I found a jazz tutor, and I found a guitar tutor and things like that, and almost built my own kind of education. Hmm. I think was also in part from the fact that I'm very much a country bumpkin at heart. I've grown up in round farms and in farming and in the hills, and the thought of going into the big city terrified me as a young man. So I was like, I wonder if I could build my own kind of education and university around me. So yeah, it was very much more that route than playing with people. And I was lucky to meet some fantastic musicians along the way who gave me a lot of time, in particular a phenomenal gypsy jazz guitarist from the UK called Gary Potter, who I really cut my teeth with him for a couple of years. He took me under his wing and really showed me a lot of the stuff I needed to learn.
When you were first playing guitar, does that imply you were largely self-taught or playing to records, things of that nature?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My parents were kind enough to get me small pockets of tuition here and there just to sort of give me a bit of technique and things like that. Yeah. But yeah, on the whole, it was just wanting to learn the things that I was hearing. So yeah, from records and other players.
Did you find that when you started to work with an actual tutor or enter into more formal work with a teacher, did you have to unlearn anything? Did you pick up bad habits or bad technique?
I think on technique, yeah, definitely. They kind of, you know, whip you into shape, a good tutor. But I was lucky. I had some really good tutors, and they really embraced where I was coming from and what I wanted to do. Mm. And they never tried to shape me into their version of what they thought a good player would be. They were very encouraging. And it was through those tutors that I heard some of the music that really took me in different paths and different directions. I remember I had a great guitar teacher when I was really young called Tim, and he used to make me mixtapes. I'd listen to a little bit of Cream from my dad. Then he'd make me a mixtape of Buddy Guy and B.B. King and other blues players, and was expanding and was teaching me kind of music history and things like that without me even knowing it. I just thought, oh, this is cool. I've got a tape to listen to.
That's phenomenal. I think the algorithm tries to do that today.
Yeah, right.
What axe do you play? What's your main equipment?
Oh, I wish I had it here to hand. I don't. I've got a beautiful guitar that's made just a few miles down the road from where I live. It's made here in Mid Wales by a luthier called Rob Williams. I've known about Rob for a long, 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 long time. And I used to fawn over his guitars in the local music shop, but I could never afford one. Oh, it must have been 20 odd years ago. I remember saying, like, I was a precocious little 18 year old. And I was like, look, listen, Rob, you need to make me a guitar and endorse me, man. And he was like, nah, I don't even like working for money, so I'm not giving you a guitar, you know? I was like, okay. But I've chipped away at him over the years, and eventually he agreed to do a guitar build with me. And I've been playing that guitar for the last sort of 2 years.
So you informed a lot of the sort of specifications. You really built it for what you wanted.
It was definitely a collaboration. I mean, Rob's the genius behind all this. He's an incredible, incredible craftsman. He's a real artist. I just sort of pop in and go, yeah, I like fancy something that's going to be a bit like this or a bit like that. And then he really brought the whole thing to life. But yeah, he's incredible. I thoroughly recommend checking his guitars out. robwilliams.co.uk.
Excellent. We'll link to that from the show notes too. Something you said earlier about trying to create your own universe without necessarily having to leave the place that you either felt comfortable with or that was important to you. Where you're at now in your life, do you feel as though you've done that? You've created the universe in the place you want to be? Like, has that been a successful venture for you?
I don't know how much of it I can take credit for myself, but things do seem to have worked out in a very small radius around me, particularly in the last few years. And a lot of it seems almost freaky by chance. So I met my now wife when we were both living in totally different areas, the other ends of the country. We met, and then it happened that we actually both came from this area, almost within miles of each other. But because of the age difference when we were younger, obviously we wouldn't have known each other. I'm 6 years her elder. The band I've got now, it still boggles my mind every time I say it. They all live within a stone's throw of where I am, and they're all incredible musicians in their own right and young guys. And I think I'd struggle to find a band that good if I moved to the biggest city in the UK. I mean, for me, they're just perfect. They're fantastic. And there's now a scene sort of bubbling up. I mean, we're really rural where we are. We have to drive 11 miles to find the nearest shop and things like that. And we're a small country. I know in America, that probably doesn't sound like very far. But for here, that maybe is the equivalent of, I don't know, 60 miles for you. But yeah, there's more starting to happen. And there are things, I think a lot of arty people have got bored of the hustle bustle of the city, and the allure of the quietness of the hills and being in nature has drawn a lot of people to these areas. And because of that, they're all starting to create scenes, art scenes, music scenes. As gigs and venues opening. It feels good.
That's incredible. What was the experience there during COVID?
Yeah, the lockdown and pandemics were terrible for everybody. It was obviously, it brought down class systems. It took everything apart. Everybody was affected in some degree. And we were very fortunate where we live because we are very rural. You make sacrifices on the one hand. There's no hospitals. There's nothing like that. But we'd have to take a helicopter ride to get to our nearest kind of, you know, seriously good size hospital if you were in an accident or something like that. However, when lockdown happened, you know, we were blessed really to be where we were with space and freedom and air to breathe.
The cities were awful. I mean, there's no other way around it. It was sounds very terrible. I'm originally from the East Coast of the United States. I live outside of Seattle now, and I was in New York for a long time. And seeing the news out of New York during the pandemic was heartbreaking, really just the height of it was really awful. What's the state of the collaboration? Are you and Aaron continuing to work together? Is there more work to be done? Or was this a phase for you both? Like, how do you think about it going forward?
We're just getting going, I think.
Nice. Yeah,
we've got a lot more to offer. Aaron's just opened up a 6-week exhibition. It opened yesterday, where she's displaying all of the originals that she did for the album, as well as some large scale interpretations and developments of those pieces she's done. She hosted a really successful opening yesterday, which was great. We all went along and we were spinning the record for people to listen to as well while they were walking around. And the response to her work was great. And it was really nice to see her work getting exclusive attention and credit without a band getting in the way. It was great to kind of just focus on what she'd done. It was lovely talking to everybody. You know, they're really invested in everything that she's doing, and they seem pretty chuffed that she's got a band collaborating with her as well.
Yeah, it's a unique and interesting collaboration. And in so much as, like you said before, there's a bit of a scene or an influx of art-minded people in your region, it must be very nice for people to see, oh, it is possible to find collaborators and to create new things. You don't have to necessarily be in a big city. I would imagine it's inspiring for people.
Yeah, I hope so. I think it would certainly inspire me. Other collaborations I've seen have inspired me in the past. And I think collaborating is really crucial in this day and age. The state of music and the arts in the UK is difficult at the moment. There's not that many outlets. There's not that much sort of sustainable paying work. And there's a lot of incredibly talented people out there. As well as sharing creative ideas, a collaboration can help you share audiences as well.
Commercial sort of aspirations aside, do you have a sense of what's the ideal room or the ideal sized venue in which to present what you and the band are doing with Aaron? Does it like a room of a certain size or scale?
It obviously is something we do think about and talk about in the long drives to gigs. I think it has to be large enough to accommodate the tech behind what we're doing. So we need like a large scale projection screen for Aaron's work to have the impact it deserves. And ideally some good kind of in-house technicians to handle like, you know, sympathetic lighting and things like that, so that the experience is big enough to create an impact visually on the audience. But then the room also has to be small enough that four guys improvising music on stage can interact with their audience and feel like we're all part of the same experience together. It's certainly not a sort of stage show where we'd be up on a stage and the audience are down there in the stalls. We like to be on the level with the audience and things to be very much like, you know, almost audience within, we call it the splash zone.
Yeah. What's the feedback from the audience? Like, do they know what they're getting when they buy a ticket and come in? What do you think the audience experience has been?
It's been mixed. We've been doing a lot of, I don't know, outreach gigs, if you like, into venues that wouldn't normally have jazz, wouldn't normally have something quite like this, or maybe some venues that wouldn't normally have anything, some places. And then we've been doing a few kind of, you know, jazz club gigs where they're having jazz 7 nights a week. And the response has been different for obvious reasons, but then there's been like a line through it as well where I think because of the visual element, that's really woken people up. And I think that's helped them to stay engaged with the show from start to finish. Yeah.
given how sort of open and excited your tone is and how I'm hearing you speak about the collaboration and your aspirations for the future of it, I take it you don't really have concerns about the music being lost or being secondary, or have there been moments where you feel like you have to compete with another sort of art form on your stage?
No, not at all. And that, though, I think comes down to the people involved in the project. There's kind of six of us that make this project work. So we've got the four musicians in the band, and we've got Aaron, and we've got my wife, Zoe, who handles all of the kind of admin and everything. You don't have to worry. Everybody's got each other. You know, we're all holding each other up. I have no worry that Aaron's going to do anything other than try and make the rest of us look and present great to the audience, just as she has no worry that we're there to holding her. And I think with that kind of symbiotic relationship where you know that everybody's got each other's backs, there's no egos, there's no hierarchy. It's, I know it's called the Will Barnes Quartet, but that doesn't mean that it's me and my backing band. And just because it's featuring Erin doesn't mean that she's separate from what we're doing. And I think because of that trust and that kind of symbiotic thing we've got together with this group of people, that it's never an issue.
Does the quartet gig without her?
Yeah, we do. And we gigged a lot without her before. And now we still do some of our smaller gigs where sometimes the technology just isn't at a gig for us to be able to do it. They've just got nothing in place. They're not a big enough gig. So we'll still go and do stuff without her. But we'll quite often deviate a bit from the show that we would do with her. So it's a chance that we could try out new material, play a few jazz standards that might not be appropriate in the main show.
So what's next for you musically? Is there another album project on the horizon, or are you still, for lack of a better way to say it, in cycle on the current project? How are you thinking about that? Is there another songbook ready to emerge?
Yes, there's definitely material. There's always material. We are definitely in the cycle for the Source of the Seven. It's probably going to be an 18-month cycle that we're 6 months into at the moment. So I'd say another 12 months just to keep taking this out. It'll develop as it goes on. The second leg of the tour begins in May. So there'll be developments to the music, developments to the visual element. But yeah, there's certainly another concept and more ideas brewing for another album. I'm keen, excited.
Wonderful. How far afield do you travel for the live shows? Are you primarily in the United Kingdom, or are you getting onto the continent and other places, or how do you think about that?
To date with this project, we haven't ventured off the mainland UK, but there's things in the pipeline. We certainly do want to take it further afield. Yeah, we'd love to.
There's some beautiful opportunities for different types of venues as well when you start to think about throughout Europe, Western Europe. Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned New York, because that's the one that Erin's got her sights firmly fixed on. She really wants to get us. And I was like, you'd be making all my dreams come true. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And it's very interesting because there's so many, you know, you said earlier about places that might not necessarily have jazz or have music at all. There's so many different ways to conceive of a venue now, the gallery in a museum, or there's just so many places that if you start to look at space that way, where you're like, oh, I could project on that wall and have the band here and the audience there. And all of a sudden, yeah, you know, lots of different types of places become options for venues.
And I think sometimes those can be the magic ones as well. You know, I love taking, like you say, the foyer of a museum and turning it into, you know, Birdland for a night.
Thank you so much for making time to do this. It's such a fascinating project, and the music is wonderful. And that's all I have to go on right now because I haven't been able to see the live show. But if you do make it to the States, maybe that'll be a good excuse to build a trip to New York for me. But thank you so much.
Hey, it's been a real pleasure for me. Obviously, I just want to do a quick shout out to my main guys. I never got to mention them. Jack, who's our piano player, and Clovis, our fantastic double bass player, and James, our amazing drummer. Without those guys, none of this would be possible.
Thank you so much, Will Barnes. And as always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host and executive producer, Lawrence Purrier. We're produced and edited by Michael Donaldson, with theme music by Q Burns' Abstract Message. If you would like to support our work, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit us online at spotlightonpodcast.com. There you'll find our free episode archive, weekly postings on our official blog, and a ton more. Thanks for listening, be safe, and stay in touch.